What we've been assembling in the course of these lectures is the Philosopher's Toolkit. We've been pulling together a set of conceptual techniques and strategies, tips, methodologies, and rules of thumb for thinking more clearly, thinking with greater focus, more effectively, more accurately, and for building stronger and more rational patterns of inference and argument. In this lecture, I want to take a different perspective on some of those techniques and on a few more. This time around, I want to talk about the Philosopher's Toolkit in terms of some of the great thinkers who have used it and added to it. This time around, I want to look at some important thinking tools used by looking at some of the great thinkers. Everybody will have their own selection of the greats, of course, and there are plenty to choose from. I'll pick just a few, treating them chronologically and with one central question in mind. What was it that made these thinkers great? Let's start with Plato, though Plato, you may be surprised to learn, wasn't even his real name. He was Aristocles, son of Ariston. Plato was a nickname. It means stocky or broad-shouldered. So let's start with that great thinker, Stocky. Plato's influence has been enormous. All of Western philosophy has been characterized as a series of footnotes to Plato. But what made Plato so great? I think there are two things that stand out. First and foremost, he saw the power of abstraction. It's amazingly hard to say what abstraction is, though we all know how to do it. When you think not in terms of this specific triangle scratched in the sand, or that one drawn in chalk on the board, or this other one cast as a shadow, but about that shape in general, you're abstracting. When you think not of a Valentine's box of chocolates or a birthday or graduation present, but rather of giving in general, you're abstracting. Abstraction gives us the power of generality. It does so by simplifying. In abstraction, we simplify away the differences of different cases. The sand of triangles drawn in sand, the chalk of triangles in chalk, and think simply in terms of the shape they have in common. In order to think abstractly, you don't add on, you don't complexify, you subtract, you simplify. The realm of abstractions is what people talk of as Plato's heaven. But Plato didn't think he was talking about abstractions removed from reality. He thought the realm of abstraction was the true reality. For Plato, the world we experience around us is just an illusory, imperfect, and distant echo of the true reality of abstraction. Abstraction is a crucial tool in all individual thought. But I think there's another thing that makes Plato great, and it's entirely different. Plato's works are dialogues, not monologues. Crucial to the dialogues is interaction between multiple points of view, multiple opinions, and multiple people. The emphasis is on social rationality. Ideas is something we work through together. What about Aristotle? What makes him great? Aristotle founded logic by seeing things with a very particular vision. Deep in the complicated and messy process that is thinking, deliberation, discussion, and argument, about all the complicated and messy things that are humanly important, Aristotle saw something amazingly simple. He saw structure. The ability to see that structure gave him an idea. Maybe we can systematize thought. Thinking's often difficult. Because of built-in psychological biases, our thinking often goes wrong. We connect dots that aren't really there. But if we could systematize thought, we might be able to make it easier. If we could systematize it, we might also be able to avoid some of those biases. We could make our thinking faster and more accurate and more effective. That vision we owe to Aristotle. It's a vision that extends even into contemporary computers. Systematizing, formalizing, mechanizing thought is what computers are all about. They're all built from the basic elements of logic. It's not quite Aristotle's logic, but we wouldn't have it without his precedent. But there's something else that makes Aristotle great. I think it's in direct contrast to Plato's abstraction. It's a necessary counterbalance. Plato thought it was the abstract that was truly real. Aristotle insisted on the lessons of experience. He was a real-world observer. Many of his works are cited as the first in biology, the parts of animals, the generation of animals, the movement of animals. There aren't any true experiments in Aristotle. That came much later. But he thinks that real knowledge of the world demands more than a glimpse into Plato's heaven. Real knowledge demands looking at what the real world is really like. This contrast between Plato and Aristotle is captured in Raphael's painting, The School of Athens. At the center, Raphael has painted Plato and Aristotle deep in discussion. Plato, the great teacher, is pointing upward toward the abstract. Aristotle, his rebellious student, is gesturing with a level hand toward the concrete reality before him. Any attempt to track down the first scientific experiment is bound to create controversy, both historical controversy and controversy as to what constitutes an experiment. But there's little controversy that experimentation first comes into its own during the Renaissance. Early experimentation was often used to question the authority of Aristotle. That was certainly true of Galileo, who has to rank as one of the great thinkers on anyone's list. The major lesson from the great experimenters is, don't trust authority, not even Aristotle's. Don't rely on what most people think. Don't be satisfied with what seems reasonable in an armchair. Design an experiment and put it to the test. Galileo was an aggressive and indefatigable observer. He didn't invent the telescope, for which there are patent applications in the Netherlands in 1608. But by 1609, he had built himself increasingly powerful versions, and he had turned his telescope to the heavens. Night after night, he carefully recorded craters on the moon, the phases of Venus. He not only saw the moons of Jupiter, but figured out what they really were. We've mentioned Galileo's legendary experiment, dropping a musket ball and a cannonball from the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Whatever Aristotle thought, whatever anybody thought, Galileo's experiment showed that things fall at the same rate regardless of weight. But precisely how do things fall? Do they reach a designated speed and stay there? That was Aristotle's answer, by the way. Or do they keep moving faster? Precisely how much faster? In order to investigate those questions, Galileo built a model. What he really wanted to know was how things accelerate in free fall. But his tools weren't precise enough to measure that. Instead, he rolled balls down an inclined plane, a wooden ramp with a groove down the middle. With as much accuracy as his tools would allow, he measured the speed with which objects passed successive marks down the plane. He found principles that applied whatever the angle of the ramp and generalized from those to answer the question about acceleration in free fall. So one measure of Galileo's greatness, putting the question to the test. Another measure, using a question he could address in order to get a handle on a question he couldn't. If Galileo is the founding figure in modern science, Descartes may be the founding figure in both modern philosophy and modern psychology. He's known for the phrase, "I think, therefore I am." He was also the inventor of Cartesian coordinates, a triumph both of visualization and conceptual linkage. Algebraic equations translate into visual shapes in the Cartesian plane. One of Descartes' major works is the Discourse on Method of 1637. Its full title shows how it ties in with these lectures. Discourse on the Method of Rightly Conducting One's Reason and of Seeking Truth in the Sciences. And what is that method? Descartes says, divide each of the difficulties under examination into smaller parts. We called that divide and conquer. He says, starting with what is simplest and easiest to know, ascend little by little to the more complex. He says, never accept anything as true which you don't clearly know to be such. Avoid precipitancy and prejudice. The Discourse on Method is full of good advice. To be possessed of a vigorous mind isn't enough. The prime requisite is rightly to apply it. I'd certainly put Sir Isaac Newton on the list of great thinkers, but not perhaps for the reasons you'd expect. Newton is known as a great formalizer, but he was a great experimentalist as well. When bubonic plague hit England in 1664, Cambridge University closed its doors for 2 years. Newton went home to his mother's house in Lincolnshire. There, in a darkened room, he started playing with prisms. Everyone knew that light through a prism casts a spectrum of a rainbow. If you let light from a circular hole through a prism, as Newton did, the result is an oval or oblong shape that distributes the colors top to bottom. But what did that mean? The prevailing view was that the prism stained the light into different colors. But that wouldn't explain why the shape was an oblong. By ingeniously playing with prisms, Newton was able to show that what the prism did was to bend different colors of light differently, what we call different wavelengths. White light isn't one color. It's a composition of many. We know from his notebooks that Newton didn't follow any rigid scientific method. He just tried lots of things, inventively and on the fly, just to see what happened. He played with a prism just to see what happened. Only against that background did he set out systematically to try to explain what he had seen. Newton's example carries a very important lesson about the two things effective thinking requires. Each has its place, each is needed, each is worthy of respect. One requirement is creative exploration. Good thinking, whether experimental or not, requires that we take time to play with ideas. Creative conceptual play can't be forced. It can't be scheduled. It has to be play. Genuinely creative thinking can't be regimented. Children know this intuitively. But creative conceptual play isn't enough. Good thinking also requires a second phase, in which one squints critically at the creative results. One tries to tack them down and figure out what they really mean. That's the stage at which Newton asks, what precisely has been shown? Can we formulate those results more clearly? How exactly does the experiment refute established doctrine? Both of those sides of thinking, the creative and the systematic, appear in Newton's notebooks. When you read a finished scientific article, it often looks as if the work was systematic through and through. But don't be deceived. New thinking, in science, as anywhere else, has to be based in creative play. Creative play alone isn't enough. We need to tack it down. But tacking it down isn't enough either. We need creative thinking in order to give us material worth working with. I said Newton was also a great formalizer. In the 1680s, several members of the Royal Society had floated an idea as to how gravity works. The idea was that the farther two bodies were apart, the less the gravitational attraction between them. How much less? The suggestion was that their attraction fell off with the square of the distance between them. It was suggested that such a principle might explain the elliptical path of the planets around the sun. But that's as far as the idea went. Nobody could tack the idea down mathematically. Edmund Halley was a participant in that discussion. In August of 1684, he went to visit Isaac Newton in Cambridge. What kind of curve, Halley asked him, would be described by the planets, supposing the force of attraction toward the sun to be reciprocal to the square of their distance? Newton said, an ellipse. How do you know? Halley asked. I have calculated it, Newton said. Halley asked to see the calculations, but Newton couldn't find them in this messy stack of papers around him. They arrived several months later. Newton had been perfecting some details. Those calculations became the core of Newton's famous Principia. In Newton the Great Formalizer, we again see the power of simplification. He simplifies the problem of gravitational forces by first considering the attraction between just two bodies. Calculating gravitational attraction for three or more turns out to be astoundingly difficult. Newton also simplifies the problem by treating them as points rather than planets. Halley used the principles of Newton's Principia to predict that a comet that had been recorded in 1531 1607 and 1682 would reappear in 1758. We know it as Halley's Comet. It appears every 75 to 76 years. If you missed it in 1986, that was a terrible year for visibility. Tell your grandkids to check it out in 2061. Newton's life overlaps with another great thinker, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. Ironically, the thing they have in common is the thing that made them bitter enemies, the calculus. Who invented calculus? They both did, independently. Newton developed his form first, but he kept the technique secret, using it to find results which he then presented in more standard mathematical form. Leibniz developed his form a little later, but published first. These two great formalizers could have been the best of friends, but they weren't. They fell victim to all the traps of polarization, with charges and countercharges of priority and plagiarism. Indeed, their defenders continued that polarization long after both Newton and Leibniz were dead. That's a negative lesson from the great thinkers. Avoid unnecessary polarization. It was Descartes who said, "The greatest minds, as they are capable of the highest excellences, are open likewise to the greatest aberrations." Newton thought space and time were absolutes. That all changes with Einstein, who we've used as an example of great thinking throughout. Einstein was the great visualizer, amazingly flexible and looking at things an entirely different way. Now, wait a minute. I've been trying to track some of the great thinkers, but I notice that I keep coming up with either philosophers or physicists. What about the great thinkers in biology, psychology, or the social sciences? Remember that history of philosophy that I sketched in the very first lecture. In the beginning, everything was philosophy. It was only over centuries that different disciplines split off on their own. Aristotle was the first great biologist. Descartes clearly plays a major role in the history of psychology. Darwin was one of the greats, perhaps the great, in the history of biology. How is one to explain speciation, the development of species? Darwin uses a strategy of analogy. The analogy is laid out clearly in the opening passages of The Origin of Species. He says that people who have bred and worked with animals have long known that you can cultivate particular traits by selective breeding. Perhaps that same kind of selection happens in nature. That analogy is what the theory of natural selection is all about. Freud is clearly one of the greats in psychology. His major insight? That so much of our mental processing goes on below the level of consciousness. And that's a lesson we've returned to again and again. As disciplines peeled off from philosophy in the 20th century, as philosophy of mind became psychology, as philosophy of man became anthropology, as parts of social philosophy became sociology, something else happened in our intellectual history, something that carries an important lesson of its own. Single great thinkers working alone were slowly replaced by research communities working together. We've used important results from social psychology throughout the course. But that work doesn't come from a single great thinker. It's a product of social rationality. Sometimes it's not a single great thinker you need, but a great intellectual community. Even in the collaborative science of the 20th century, there are individuals who stand out. Let me end by returning to my candidate for the smartest man of the 20th century, John von Neumann. What makes von Neumann great is the fact that he worked so flexibly across so many disciplines. He's known for contributions in mathematics, in economics, in physics, in computer science. We've said that he deliberately memorized formulae in the back of textbooks. Why? So that he could recognize a similar formalism applicable across fields, so that he could see the links between very different disciplines. The lesson? Stay open to unexpected connections. Von Neumann clearly prepared for unexpected connections. As Louis Pasteur said, chance favors the prepared mind. I want to apply some of the tools we've talked about to a von Neumann problem. If you do this right, you should be able to outsmart von Neumann. We've emphasized visualization. We've emphasized simplification. We've emphasized flexibility, the flexibility required to stand back and see a problem differently. I want you to use all of those, but pay particular attention to simplification. Von Neumann loved parties. At Princeton, he'd throw a party for his colleagues about once a week, heavy drinking 1950s style. Because of his reputation, people would come to the party with problems for von Neumann to solve. They'd pose him a problem. Standing there with a drink in his hand, he'd rock back and forth and try to come up with the answer, which he almost always did. Here's a problem they gave von Neumann one night. The important thing is that there's a trick to it. If you can visualize the problem flexibly and with an eye to simplification, you should be able to see the trick. Two bicycles are approaching each other from 20 miles apart. Each is going 10 miles an hour. A fly leaves the front tire of one of the bicycles at 15 miles an hour, flies to the front tire of the other, and turns around. Goes back to the first bicycle, still at 15 miles per hour, hits the front tire, turns around. The problem is idealized, of course. The bicycles go straight toward each other at a constant speed of 10 miles per hour, and the fly loses no time in turning around. The question, how far will the fly have flown by the time it's crushed between the front tires of the two bicycles? As I say, there's a trick to the question. If you tried to work it out straight, without flexibility, you'd be doing this. You'd figure out the distance from one bicycle to where the other is by the time the fly gets there, plus the distance back to where the first bicycle is then, plus the distance back to the other bicycle, all calculated in terms of that 15 miles per hour. Figuring out just that first distance is hard. Figuring out the fly's total distance would mean adding up all those progressively smaller distances, taking the infinite sum. Whew! But there's a much simpler way to get the answer. Can you see the trick? If you want to press pause for one last time, go ahead. Visualize the problem by sketching it out, and remember, simplification is the key. Here's the trick. The bicycles are 20 miles apart, approaching each other at 10 miles per hour. How long until the bicycles hit? 1 hour. The fly speed is 15 miles per hour. So how far will it have flown by the time it's crushed between the two front tires? 15 miles. If you saw the trick, you did it the easy way. You outsmarted von Neumann. When his colleagues posed the problem, von Neumann thought about it for 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and then said, 15 miles. They said, oh, so you knew the trick. What trick, he said. I just took the infinite sum. Here, then, are some tips from the great thinkers. We've really been talking about them throughout these lectures. First tip, simplify, simplify. That's how to outsmart von Neumann. We've seen that lesson in Newton and Descartes. Break a complex problem into simple parts. Start with the simple, build up to the complex. We emphasized that strategy early on in the Tower of Hanoi problem, in going to extremes, and in the strategy of thought experiments. If you can't solve a hard problem, use a simpler model. That's what Galileo did. Simplification is what model building is all about, from the Wright brothers' wind tunnel to the Mississippi River Basin model, to Schelling's segregation model. Plato's abstraction represents the power of generality you can get, not by adding, but by subtracting detail, by simplifying. Second tip, look for patterns, but watch out for them too. Visualization allows us to harness something we're great at, visual pattern recognition. It lets us think faster, more intuitively, and more powerfully. Aristotle knew the power of visualization. He used it in his square of opposition. Einstein was one of the great visualizers. The heuristics that make us smart are often forms of pattern recognition. But the biases that lead us astray are often patterns as well. Our vivid images, like images of shark attacks, can mislead us as to true probabilities. We miss the gorilla in the room because we're paying attention to some other pattern. Patterns are extremely powerful. That's why it's important to put them to work and why it's important to handle them with care. Third tip, think systematically. Maybe we can systematize thought. That was the Aristotelian vision. Thinking systematically is what gave Newton his edge. We've developed a number of tools for systematic thought, tools in statistics, in probability, and decision theory. One simple lesson in thinking systematically goes all the way to the bat and ball example in the first lecture. Want to think better? Check your work. Fourth tip, put it to the test. A respect for the reality behind the abstractions is the difference between Plato and Aristotle. Respect for reality runs throughout the whole history of experiment. Charles Sanders Peirce thought of science as the one really self-correcting technique for fixation of belief. Popper emphasizes that genuine science demands risk, the risk of falsifiability. Galileo is the patron saint of experimentation. Simple and beautiful experiments go all the way from Newton's prism to Richard Feynman's O-rings. Do you really want to know what reality entails? Ask her. Put it to the test. Fifth tip, think socially. Many of the complexities we face are social complexities. They require thinking in terms of multiple perspectives and multiple players. Thomas Hobbes knew the importance of thinking socially. So did Jean-Jacques Rousseau. That kind of thinking is the whole goal of contemporary game theory. Inevitably, there are social threats to good thinking as well. We have to watch out for mere rhetoric, for standard fallacies, for the tricks of advertisers. Newton and Leibniz are an unfortunate example of the pitfalls of polarization, even for great minds. We've tried to emphasize ways of escaping those traps. Plato's dialogues are the first great works in philosophy. They emphasize this social side to thinking. Plato takes an optimistic view. He thinks we often think most powerfully when we think together. Despite the pitfalls, I want to think he's right. Sixth tip, think with both sides of your brain. Newton combined the power of creative play with systematic critique. Great thinking requires disciplined imagination. Both parts need to be there, both the discipline and the imagination. We emphasized early on that emotion need not be the enemy of rationality if used in the right domain. We couldn't do without fast and frugal heuristics. But for long-range decisions, we need careful calculation as well. Remember Kahneman's System 1 and System 2. We need both. Let me add a seventh tip that appears in all the great thinkers. Give yourself time to think. Descartes must have been a phenomenally quick thinker. And yet he says, those who travel slowly may yet make far greater progress than those who run. Google's engineers are given one day a week to work on something entirely of their own. It's unfortunate, but these days our last bastions for free-range thinking seem to be the shower and the commute to work. Real thinking demands conceptual exploration, and that just takes time. Do like Google. Do like all the great thinkers did. Give yourself time to think. Of course, the great thinkers have more lessons to teach. Don't trust authority. Don't trust the majority. Don't even trust your own prejudices as to what's the obvious answer. Think for yourself. That's a lesson clear in Galileo, Descartes, and Einstein. Stay flexible. The right way to think about something may be one no one has used before. Be prepared to try a new view. Stay open to the unexpected. Each of the great thinkers worked with a conceptual toolkit, but none of them built it alone. All inherited a set of conceptual tools from their predecessors. Newton said, "If I have seen farther, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants." All added to the toolkit and then passed it on. That cultural heritage has now been passed to you. The Philosopher's Toolkit, to use, to apply, to add to improve, to pass on. It's wonderful to peer into the future and realize there are more great thinkers to come.